Dr. Jamie Cohen. So this is so exciting. All right. I just don't think enough of us appreciate enough how lucky we are to have you join us today. I'm not going to read through all of your credentials. Holy crap, that's amazing.
Thank you.
Maybe you can sort of spice up the conversation as we're chatting, but found it fascinating your pieces in anything but I think anything but fame, right? And that's the name of the and how you sort of provided some context to what's pretty crazy environment. So I know that others have questions, and I encourage you all to have questions for him. But let me start, okay? Unless I don't think we need to do an intro. Maybe if you ask a question, you can say what you do. Okay. So the first one I have is this sort of overarching global type question. We're witnessing what I think is explosion of what I call the everyday content creator. Okay. And I think it's quite a shift that this sort of average everyday person is incorporating social media benefits, social media attributes, all this sort of stuff to express themselves, their opinions, their philosophies. Didn't used to be that way entirely. What are the consequences really of this trending? Will we be losing the ability, and I would say necessity, of the kind of person-to-person relationship building really necessary to build a business and our community? So that's kind of my big thing. Okay, as we're going down this steamrolling down this pathway, what might be the consequences of that, both positive and negative?
I mean, it gets a we got a preview of it several years ago during the pandemic. That was what I think is the impetus for what caused or is causing the what I call now we are very close to what I call it, which is the TikTokification of everyday life. That's what I call it. And I think that is where what Sophie Bishop, the researcher Sophie Bishop, calls influencer creep. And that is where we feel like we need to participate in these environments. And that's and for those of you who are writers or those of you who are running a small company, very often your agents or your business partners or even your customers will ask questions about why aren't you online? Why aren't you doing this? Can't you make sales? If you're a writer and you have a book, most publishers are no longer marketing at all. So they are asking the producers or the writer to do more on-screen entertainment. And so I think that's influencer creep. Influencer creep is definitely causing people to feel like the mediated self is more important than the public self. But for any of you who haven't read it, you should read it. Any of Doug Rushkoff's recent work, Team Human or Survival of the Richest, both of them have a similar thesis, which is the really the only way forward is small community, unscalable media, peer-to-peer, person-to-person environments. And the one thing I think that was lost and is mentioned quite often in Rushkoff's book is the nuance of communication. In other words, like when we're mediated like this in between like a screen, it's a good substitute for real life. And this is helpful when we're literally over 3,000 miles from each other. I mean, that's an important way of connecting, you know, but when we have the opportunity to be in person, there's nothing like seeing somebody communicate. When we communicate with a camera, we're only seeing the bust. We're seeing from the statue in the museum up, you know, we're not seeing the communication that happens with a twitch of the leg or the boredom of a finger, you know, you're not seeing the rest of the communication. So screens are a frame around reality that is more exclusive than inclusive. And I think after the pandemic, I think everything, there's this idea, oh, we went back to before, we went back to normal. And I don't think so. I think what we've done is adapted to the new mediated environment. I think that's where we are now. We're now in this very much the space where we have supplemented our version of ourself into commodified spaces, which is this is currently uncommodified, but it does mean that we are gaining the skills to be on social media, which are fully commodified. You're anytime you put anything on social media, anything, you are doing something commodified because the platform works because ads are sold. So there's no way to do it with an uncommodified experience. And when you've done that, you lose a bit of your humanness to the machine, so to speak.
Well, you know, Susan, sometimes Nicola have been part of some of the person-to-person networking events I've hosted here in Victoria. And I make a living and have running businesses that use the internet to market them. And I've been very successful at that. However, when I have one-on-ones, I feel guilty that I'm doing the internet stuff because the one-on-ones are so powerful, are so better. Doing business and understanding humanity and understanding relationship, that I feel bad about the other way. Like, is that called something?
What is the opposite, you mean?
I'm guilty of
Yeah,
benefiting
good
from this
question.
kind of,
I don't know. That's a really phenomenal question. I'll literally have to ask Doug Rushkoff that. Because I don't think we have a term for what reality was. There's a it's untermed because we assume that to be normal, but it isn't anymore, right? Like it is, we are leaning away from that. So yeah, there is humanness, team human is what he calls it, but there's got to be a better word for it, I'm sure.
And I will. I know others have questions, but sorry, I'm on a bit of a roll here. I lost my dog before Christmas.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Terrible pain. And pre-internet, I would have written. I find writing therapeutic. I write if whatever feeling I have, I write. And then I would do nothing. It would have just hang out with her. Well, I published it on a good dog Facebook group,
Oh,
and frankly, was terribly helpful.
good.
It was really helpful. I mean, not terribly. So there's an instance where all of this stuff was actually really good. I was able to reach out to a lot of people who helped me through that process.
I think part of social media, though, does there's not we don't talk enough about the bright spots, I think. I think a lot of people want to talk about how bad social media is or the at ways in which it influences people to do bad behavior or even bad actors exploiting it. But we don't talk about that, like in a sense, it's a place of like grief or like sharing feelings. Like those spaces are supportive, and I don't think they're fostered enough. I'm writing a book now called Critical Internet Literacies, and at the end of it, the last part is building resilient communities online. And resilient communities are spaces in which you can disagree but still feel safe, you know. And I think that is a rarity in digital spaces because everybody wants to play to the extremes. But when you find a place where it's shared grief or shared emotions, like you're actually in a resilient community. You're in a space where it doesn't matter what political ideology you're coming from. It doesn't matter where what your inherent biases are. You know, it's you're just with people. And so there is, I think, first, social media is never going away. Ever for the rest of our life. So it means that we have to find resilient communities or we're going to go insane. Like we have to find those spaces. So I'm sorry for your loss, but I am happy that you found a place to grieve with a community because that is an underrated aspect of social media we don't talk about enough.
It was remarkable. I'm sure others want to have some questions for you. If not, I have a list.
Sure. I'm here to answer anything. I've been studying social media since inadvertently since 2006. I was one of the first YouTube researchers. And I have in 2015 I published or I submitted, it didn't get published in 2017, the first peer-reviewed paper on Pepe the Frog. So it's like one of the earliest pieces of cultural politic essays about this, and it's given me a lot of mileage. You know, the unfortunate downside is that my study looks at some of the worst things that have ever existed by humankind, and I have to translate that so people can not be afraid of it. So I'm glad to answer anything.
Fabulous. Go ahead. Anyone have something? I'm sure you do.
What are your thoughts? I watched a news story last night about deepfake and how scams are being run through like voicemail now, where they'll find video on social media of say a family member. They'll take that voice sample. They'll write their script of "I have a problem. I need to borrow money," whatever, and then play that back. That like right now, I think people that are slightly technical can do that. But we're not far off from just having an app and downloading it, and anybody can do it. That's going to flood social media with so much garbage. And it's going to be garbage that's so well done, we're not going to know.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts around, I guess, one, what do you think the resilience of the social media platforms themselves and their engagement would be once that happens? And two, how do we as people live with that sort of experience? Because there's going to be videos of ourselves that we didn't make, but it could be any of us just because of this meeting.
Yeah,
right now
data. Yep.
Saying things that we don't believe. As humans, how are we going to cope with that?
Right. Answer to question one, how social media will do it poorly. How we will with effort. I just finished a book chapter yesterday on synthetic media and how news departments could deal with it, especially in deep fake and audio cloning. And you're right. I think right now, yeah, it's not truly accessible. I think 11 Labs is fairly good. If any of you want to try it, 11 Labs is you could dump in some of your audio, create a clone, and make somebody say something. It degrades fairly rapidly, which is a good thing. It means that if you spend enough time on the phone with any AI bot, it will degrade to a point where you'll know it's AI.
Right.
But that puts a lot of onus on the consumer. You know, yes. It puts a lot of onus on the people rather than the people, the machines or the systems creating it. And I think two ways of looking at it is one is like these exploits have always exploited the vulnerable. It's been there pre-internet. It's now just accelerated or scaled. And the vulnerable have always been subject to some sort of scam in this way. And this is the scariest of all of them. You know, to me, this is an extraction method that is so unethical that it's hard to pin down, because when you scale it through AI, you're not technically a human doing it. So there's no, it's like a outsourcing evil, you know? From a digital perspective or a platform perspective, trust and safety teams are already using AI for content moderation. Intel has developed a fake checker. I can't remember the name of the product. And the product enables AI to zoom far in to a person's face and it looks for blood flow. It actually checks to see if the person is real, because AI's blood flow will repeat, whereas a human never repeats. We are completely unique organisms. So the machine does do a fairly good 96 percentile detection, but are social media even, do they care? Is this something that is like worrisome to them? I don't think it's worrisome yet. I think what we're going to see, and saw it with, the case of Joe Biden being spoofed in the United States, I think it was in New Hampshire. That I think is going to become more problematic globally. I think in different countries and different places, you're going to see spoofing or cloning that is going to cause an incident. And I think we're sitting on the brink of an incident that is going to reveal how we handle that. But I think I always have to lean back on what I think is the most important thing. We have to make all of this a constant conversation. We can't assume it's on the internet or it's technology and we can't understand it. Everyone can understand it. But just like finances, financial literacies have been purposely designed as literacies to design a way that you have to trust somebody to handle your finances. Same with technology. So AI literacies are accessible, but the technologists don't want everyone to know, because then you know. So same with social media literacies. Like, all of this stuff is not... The problem is we apply old language to new products. And I think we have to understand that new language needs to be comfortably talked about with adults, children, neighbors. It can't just be something that happens somewhere else. It has to be something that happens all the time and everywhere.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I got a question, Jamie. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that you brought up Pepe. I am fascinated with meme and meme culture, and I think that it's understated the effect that it has on us as a society. It mm-hmm. just a meme isn't always necessarily just poking fun or political humor. I think that memes can affect us a great deal. What are your thoughts on the future of this art form and, politically and, to the society?
Memes are my bread and butter. and it's getting harder and harder every day to study it, because it's more expansive than ever.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was just thinking back to the previous question about the meme, about the me watching the camera, what me watching me commit a crime that I've never commit before because AI has. And it's that guy who's like exactly. Really stressed out. I think memes are the most they're old. I mean, they're as old as they can possibly be. I mean, their ideas turn into shareable media, and digital culture accelerates it, but also makes it more referential. The problem with memes today is that meme culture is deep. Like I've seen memes that you can't understand unless you've seen 1,000 memes before them, you know, like they don't even reference reality anymore. They just simply reference memes. And so that type of culture means that there's going to be secondary languages that start operating. And those aren't just visual communication. Those are actually just like the language of nuance. And I think that has more, I think, to be very honest, I think that's, we are within a decade of having a bigger problem politically when we have the new divide or a new consumer base, like Gen Z enters or Gen Alpha enters the consumer space. And they come up with a completely new language that's memetic. And we have always assumed memes are something funny or shareable and this and that. And they have it as a language, like an actual functioning language. And I have this constant feeling that everybody wants to say, oh, we're going to lean back into hieroglyphs. And I don't think so. I think we're going to lean into an explosion of a new language. Like it's almost like sci-fi books we read when we were younger, and they always made up planet names and technology that doesn't exist. Like those will be the new way that we'll talk to each other, but they'll sound silly. Like they're going to sound silly. Like even the current linguistics that are being used from AlgoSpeak is an example. Does everyone know what AlgoSpeak is?
Mm-hmm. No.
AlgoSpeak is somewhat mimetic. AlgoSpeak is AI that's been installed in content moderation systems, has basically banned certain words from being shown on screen or said. So like sex, you can't say that or type that. So users have changed it to S-E-G-G-S. Lesbian has been the dollar bean. They changed the S to a dollar sign. And so but the problem is by typing it, people pronounce it. So now people start saying the words out loud. So they're actually using mimetic language that comes from the internet in physical spaces. That is a very unique, I don't think we're talking about that enough. I think young kids in classes are still being taught in a model that like I went to school with. And like, it's a completely new world. And it's going to create a cultural divide that I think, I mean, you're right. I mean, it's just hard to grasp because it's so big. It's mimetic culture is so huge. Wow. It's just, you don't know where to start, where to read. Pepe is just one branch of millions. Mm-hmm. But there's, and I would even say at this point, Pepe is so coded at this point that you could figure out, I could almost, if somebody's using a Pepe reference, I could almost see where they're getting their information from, you know? And so what is interesting is like, it's a sorting device. Like mainstream memes like we see on Instagram versus the not great memes that you see on Reddit or 4chan. Like those, there's meme spaces in which people can communicate in very different and distinct ways. And just as a warning is that I think meme culture plays into civic engagement.
Yeah.
Because you can use a dog whistle that comes from the internet, something that is embedded or nuanced with racism or hatred or misogyny or homophobia, and lets it merge into the mainstream because it's said it by accident. But that tool also helps young people who aren't civically engaged become civically engaged. It tells them how to take action. And I think there's very, very subversive tactics in meme culture right now that can do that. And in this country, it was Let's Go Brandon. And it was a technique to get young people who may not know how to even be civically engaged to act civically. And that to me is an interesting thing that we have to look at. So I'm very tuned in to every new meme, but I'm also pretty critical of newspapers that cover the meme of the week. You know, I'm like, all right, that's going to die next week. It's not really worth writing words on this, but I get why they're doing it. Mm-hmm. I'm more interested in things that are like longitudinal, things that are going to be that stick around too long. Like right now I'm focusing on Tradwise, which is a meme, which comes from the far right and has now made its way into mainstream spaces as a influencer space.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah.
I'm glad you brought up Reddit and 4chan. You know, obviously this meme culture, this type of language has originated from those two channels, obviously 4chan being the more abrasive and racially charged. Mm-hmm. What do you think about Reddit recently going public? Do you think that's going to have more of an effect on this culture and this type of language?
I did and then I didn't. I thought so. And I think to be honest with you, I think there are world in which we communicate and have internet culture move into our space is not based on public shares or ownership of a platform, but I think more along the lines of how advertisers see it. Mm-hmm. So I think it's less about the fact that Reddit will be publicly owned rather than will advertisers still use it in the same way? And will they dictate some control over it? Because there's going to be a stock jump, you know, and then that means advertisers, that means it might cost more to advertise on a platform like that. But advertisers won't advertise if they don't feel they're safe or they're not doing it. So I think advertisers have the distinct and unique control over what is actually on a platform. And I think Reddit's public offering is more of a battle of sustaining that. So I do, I mean, now you have, instead of just the advertiser, now you have the public and the advertiser. So I definitely think there's going to be a pressure on the platform. I just don't know how it's going to play out yet.
That's why it's an interesting space.
Yep.
I have a question. Anyone else want to jump in or shall I ask it? Okay, I'll go on. So this question has some context to it before I ask it. Just let me change here. So I kind of, by virtue of age, have this before and after sort of thing in which the way that I used to react to things, the way that I would express my feelings, philosophies, etc., were different in a pre-digital environment, okay? Mm-hmm. And how they were measured were very different. So that I would write something or compose something, and I would do it in a sort of a comparative way amongst other books or amongst other people we would read. And so that has evolved, you know, very rapidly to, if putting that within a content creator context online, that it's good or it's valuable or it serves a purpose by how many hits it gets. Mm-hmm. And by how much volume I get. I can, I can objectively see how that's wrong, but subjectively, don't. Like, if I don't get enough hits, it's not good. And then seeing anything for fame, mm-hmm. I thought, you know, ultimately that I keep using this word humanity, but anyway, the humanity of measuring value was really in how good it was to ourselves and comparatively to other people's, what they're doing. What it's turning out to be is how stupid you can be.
Yes.
Gets more value. Mm-hmm. Like, we're going down this stupid path as opposed to a value path. Mm-hmm. That really annoys me because mm-hmm. I know that if I'm going to create a content creation business, I need hits mm-hmm. for that thing to work.
Yep.
Monetarily. Help me.
You are working against the algorithm. You are working against the actual structure itself. And I think I've been asked this specific question more times this year than ever before, and mostly in the context of rage bait, mostly in the context of people doing what were, when I was part of Anything for Fame and when Tyler was making that, I think he was finding some of the more outliers, the people who did these types of things, the extreme content. And in doing so, he was kind of showing like, these people exist too. It's not just your mainstream popular producers. It's also the strange weirdos who like to light themselves on fire, you know? And they're endearing. I give Tyler a lot of credit because he made them endearing. He made them human.
Yes,
you know,
did.
They're not just producers. They're young kids. And I come from a background where I did reality TV, and I know what it's like to put young people on camera and like have them try to be real. I think what's scary and what's happening right now is we're watching that become the norm. And that's because there is no such thing on social media as not doing that. Every time, I was just quoted in, I think it was Rolling Stone about this, about rage bait. And the question was, how come it works? And I said, well, the algorithm normalizes content. That's how algorithms work. It takes the average of everything, you know? So if everybody starts doing a certain type of crazy behavior, asking for the attention economy to turn their eye of Sauron on them, you know, and all of a sudden everybody's doing the same type of extreme content, that is no longer extreme. That's just content. So then you have to up that content. And then this way, then you're now the eye of Sauron turns, looks at you, and now you're getting the attention. But then everybody else starts doing that. And so it's looking around and then it becomes normal. And then it does that over and over. So there is no direction on social media except extreme. And a lot of people get kind of upset when I use that term because I say social media eventually results in extremism. And extremism, it connotates far-right extremism or stochastic terrorism. But that's not what I mean. I mean, extremism is extreme behavior. Mm-hmm. I don't know what Ava's ideology is. I know she's cynical in it. I know that Jake Hillhouse is all, they're all cynics in the film. But I don't know what political ideology, but they are extremists. You know, they are what we would consider an extremist. And so that type of extremism is that. Is that? Hang on.
Yeah.
Sorry, I lost you for a second.
You're back. You're back.
Am I back? Okay, hang on. Yeah, sorry, I just watched a glitch. That was very strange. so the normalization, and then I'm going to get my phone ready just in case I lose Wi-Fi. So because I always tethered to my phone. The problem I'm finding is like when brands or folk who are interested in becoming producers or need the internet to leverage themselves, what do you do to have the eye of Sauron on you? Like, how do you get the attention? Like, how do you get people to see you? And that type of thing is like, do you compete in the attention economy? Do you do extreme content? That being said, now here's the other side. You just have to be creative in a different way. What's interesting is that uniqueness still stands out. I've seen several ads. I've saved a couple of them. One's a PopSocket ad I get on Instagram all the time. It's a unique ad. Some ads are just so different that they do stand out. So it does require a bit more work. And this is where I push back against people who think like AI or social media will kill jobs. I think it'll increase jobs because now you need more unique creators. You need different thoughts. You need things that don't exist in an agency setting. You need things that exist outside the box. And so I think it's a matter of like finding the right person. And that usually, back to the in-person, it usually means talking to people. Yeah. It usually means asking people what they want to see, what they want to look at, how, you know, so it requires communication. The internet itself eschews that. It doesn't want you to communicate. It wants you to create one direction media. And to win the internet, you have to have two direction media.
Wow. Fascinating. Thank you. No, it's a guilt. You know, like, I just cannot believe that I'm captured by the fact that I could create something, whatever it is, publish it wherever. Mm-hmm. And if I don't get enough hits, it's not good enough. It could be the best mm-hmm. piece of work on the planet. I am annoyed by that.
Yeah, it's sad sometimes. Like, it feels like, to be honest, like, it's why I don't create. It's like, I just don't want to take the risk of that feeling of like all this work and nothing, you know, and like, it's a fear that we used to have back when we had to present papers in classrooms. And now it's like just everywhere. Yeah. And, you know, I think on the other hand, you sometimes just don't want people to see it. My opening sequence for my book is it's a strange mix of algorithm, environment, trends, attention economy and timing that sometimes that eye looks at you. Yes. And you don't want it to look at you. All right. that is not when you want to go viral. And back in the days, just before I started teaching, I was asked quite often, like the question that always happens over and over again at the time, how do you make something go viral? That was the question. Yes. And it was like 2010 through 2013 era.
It
which
still is,
like,
is, Jamie.
Yeah,
still
but everybody asked that in an agency setting. They're just like, we need this marketing plan. How do we get it to go viral? And my response every time would be like, you just don't want to. You don't want that. Like, and they're like, why not? I was like, because for those of you who don't know, maybe those who know memes know, but you don't want to be that East Down Ohio mall. All right. There was a very famous viral commercial that was so poorly made that it became a viral hit. And like, people only know it for the viral hit, not for the quality of whatever was in there. To be honest, maybe it was a nice mall. Maybe it wasn't.
It's because you can't control the virality. Right. You can't control what is viral about it.
100%. It's like when I was in film school, in TV school, they used to say, when you're done with your TV show, when you're done with the project, you can't go to every theater and explain what you missed, what you messed up on. You know, you can't show up and say, well, in this scene, it was supposed to be.
You can't provide context to every view, right?
100%. So you can't control it. Once you've published it, once it's out there, you have no control over it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the world now.
Yeah, you want the right eyeballs on, right, on what it is that you're conveying.
And I don't have the answer to that. And if I did,
we wouldn't be chatting with you probably.
Big money. Big money.
Yeah, big money.
I was chatting with, you know, Nicholas on this call. Nicola's got some fabulous content. She talks about ghosts. She talks about sort of other dimensions. It's brilliant. I'd love it.
Awesome.
Yet, always challenged. How do I get more eyeballs? How do I get more eyeballs? And you know, this is the great dilemma. You know, the great content, and oh, but we need more people to watch it. You know, to make a business out of it.
I have a solution. I have a solution. Okay. Be more extreme is what what has to happen. You got to be extreme if you want more eyeballs. Unfortunately,
isn't that what the movie taught us?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Like I just looked at those folks and went, "Holy shit!" They're yeah. Anyway, Nicole, I don't know if you want to put your two bits in your hand, but
well, I appreciate the nod. Thank you. I would say I don't want to be extreme. Mm-hmm. I think there's an audience, a ton of people out there, like all of us perhaps, who want to see content that suits them, isn't extreme, that's interesting and entertaining and informative and amusing and whatever. And mm-hmm. I'm hoping, I don't necessarily want to make huge bucks on my podcast. What I'd like to do is find an audience that appreciates what I'm doing, that digs what I'm up to, mm-hmm. and in a similar fashion feels the same. And that's what I'm struggling to do, is to sort of navigate below the surface of the, you know, being visible, just to get a strong following. I used to be in the book business, and I've heard about, you know, rock bands and stuff, and you can get an indie rock band, and if they have 1,000 dedicated fans, they can survive with 1,000 dedicated fans. They can kind of just keep mm-hmm. on going, and it's okay for them. They don't necessarily want to make a gazillion dollars and be on the big stages and have all that pressure. And that's my feeling, is I think we have a solid, interesting show. It's different. And I want to find an audience that feels the same way. And we just will keep going under the radar in our little supernatural psychic manner.
I think the advertisers, sorry, Jamie, the advertisers in this group are going to say, spend some advertising dollars to expose your show and your content to a lot more eyeballs, and then convert them to regular listeners or watchers.
Well, who do you advertise to?
Say again?
Where did you place your ads for something like this?
Well, I have an alternative to this, which is, that's the right answer, which is, you, in order to prove anything to anybody that it's got some worth, is, and this happens in publishing, like some books I've pitched won't get picked up because there's simply not enough views on the content that supports it. So there is a metric that is a minimum for people to see that as financially plausible. On the other hand, there's a Margaret Mead quote that is like, you never underestimate a small group of people sharing the same feelings and how much power they have, you know? So it's, that's paraphrasing it, but I'm much more under the belief of, there was that essay that was like 2006 or seven about long tail versus viral. And it was basically saying, you know, like, I'll lead this into one part to the other, but to me, 100 dedicated viewers are worth 10,000 times more than 1 million viewers that happen and disappear. You know, you do, advertisers have a problem with that. They do, because they don't care about that. They want to see 1 million views. They're very present oriented, where technically, if you're an influencer, so the second half of this is, I would lean into, if you're proud of your niche, lean into the hyper niche. The hyper niche is go further. And that kind of is the extreme, you know, like you are going to the extreme, but you have to lean into the likes of what your community is interested in, because if you have a hyper niche idea, so do hundreds of people. They just don't have the bravery to create the content for it. And so I'm more of the proponent of hyper niche productions, like things that are, no one likes, do something that no one likes. This way, only a few people really focus on it. And that, because if you gather 100% of the community, you now have 100%. Whereas if you have a million, you only have 1% of whatever. So that, I always see it as like that. So it's to me, it's not just about the metric, but it's also about the narrative that you have to present to an advertiser or a distributor, which is explaining your ability to maintain the audience, long tail, that is more valuable than anything. And Tyler Oakley, actually, I always talk about pairing content. I pair Anything for Fame with the documentary Generation Like, which Douglas Rushkoff produced in 2014. And he talks about Tyler Oakley, the influencer. And he Tyler Oakley, for the first several years, just had several thousand people that really liked him, that were just his fans. That's it. And he capped, technically, he had 100% audience. And that is like very good. And so influencers started, in beginning of the endorsement era, like they started leaning in and were like, wow, this guy is turning around this many sales because his audience will buy what he wants. Whereas if you don't have a dedicated audience, you're just yelling into the wind. You know, it's like, so that it's different than arena rock, where like a rock, they're all there because they bought tickets, than just shuffling a million people into the room to hear whoever, you know? So yes, you should be more extreme, but no, but not in the same way that you think of like lighting fireworks and running around. Yeah, right. Like, extreme is in find, lean into the niche, lean into the passion, because yeah. 30 people showing up passionately is worth more than 1,000 people showing up for the clout or the desire to be there. You know, we went through that in the Dada era of art and contemporary art, where it was about the crowd and the thing. And I think advertisers saw that as a unique way of selling, but we don't need that. The internet allows hyper niche to succeed.
Okay, thanks.
Yep.
Go ahead. So
I've got a question. I'm curious about this hyper niche concept. Mm-hmm. So I'm a professional coach. That's what I do. But mm-hmm. I also have online courses, which I want to sell. And one of them is mm-hmm. a networking course, hence my own. I'm passionate about it because I think it's such an important skill that very few people ever get any training in. You just kind of have to figure it out by osmosis. Mm-hmm. And yet it's really essential for transitions in your life or even changing careers. You know, it's the best way to find out if what you think you want to do is really what you want to do by talking to someone who's doing it. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking now at how I'm going to get this out there. One of the things I'm going to do is a LinkedIn newsletter specifically, because I got 3,600, not huge, but 3,600. But it'll get pushed out mm-hmm. in an email to everyone who's connected. But what would it look like to, what's this hyper niche? How would that work for me? I'm being very selfish here, sorry.
No, that's a really good point. I think the question comes back to you, which is like, what specifically sets you apart from your competition or like anybody else who might be doing it.
Yeah.
Like if you find that thing, that's the thing that you have to add in the newsletter.
Well, the thing I would say, the thing probably is that I was a horrible networker and I hated it. And now I love it. And now I'm, you know.
So you should make the Horrible Networkers Club or something. Like it's like, that's,
I would also add, you need to experiment with, you know, are you uncomfortable networking in Vancouver? Do you find it awkward to network at business events, on the West Coast, or and be specific about the types of events or the types of surroundings? And you can do 20 of those and then figure out, okay, this is resonating, this isn't resonating. Ultimately, it comes down to testing.
That's 100% right. That's
fantastic.
You should do that. Yeah. In fact, if you want to get weird, you should actually name places in which you network, like name this, the location, and talk specifically about what makes them good or bad spaces to network. And this way you gain audiences, because all of a sudden people who connect from that, because you're, again, at LinkedIn, you're dealing with SEO and you're dealing with networked keywords. So if somebody recognizes like a local business or a bar or a lounge or something in which you did a networking event, and you name like how to do it or how not to do it, sometimes that's even better, like how not to network at X place, those people are like, oh, I've been there. Oh my gosh. And they start, because you're tapping, one thing that social media misses or actually works really well on is parasocial relationships. But what it misses then is personal. It misses the actual human to human. If you could create a memory for someone, or like recall a memory, they're willing to engage. So you have to bring their, that's what my biggest problem with LinkedIn is, the broetry. That's what I call it. And broetry is the vague fortune cookie-esque type of writing where somebody writes a sentence and presses enter twice and they basically do platitudes. It's platitude after platitude after platitude. And it works because it works on SEO, but it doesn't work to convert. There's no conversion on it because everybody's just clicking like. They're not actually clicking the links. So if you want conversion, you need to have somebody remember something in which you're referring to it. And that's it. You start small. And then if it works, like the experimentation, that's a perfect thing. The internet is meant for experimentation. We forget that. Mm-hmm. You're allowed to experiment. If it didn't work, delete it.
That also applies to Nicola's situation as well. Like you're taking your genre, you're taking your theme, and then, but what sub themes, what sub niches are involved in that, and experiment with each of those.
Yep.
Right. And then in the case of networking, a type of setting like a bar, a networking event at a bar is different than a networking event at a conference or outdoors. And so I would play around with, this is the best way to network outdoors at so and such and such venue, right? Then you're 100%. Speaking directly to people.
Yep.
Yeah.
And take that. And you could, if you did that well, it's a little bit more time, it's more resource intensive because you're actually writing, but you could eventually merge that into a Substack newsletter and then eventually into a small book, like a print on demand book. And then you have a little, then you get an ISBN and you have stories. You know, you could interview people, what's their best and worst. When you engage the public, they get to then have their stories. You just ask their permission. And you have a guide. And that's, I mean, I did that for my last book with virtual presenting about multimedia production. I interviewed 25 producers and just said same 7 questions over and over again. But you know what I'm doing? I'm creating my audience, then shares their audience. And so now they have an audience. And so they want to share it.
That's the beauty of the podcast too. It's a big reason why we started our podcast. Yeah. Podcast to me, I've got an SEO background, to me is the new SEO, is the new backlink. What backlinks used to be in the early 2000s, they were, if you had a ton of backlinks, you rose to the top of a search engine. Mm-hmm. That doesn't exist anymore. Backlinks are, they just don't really matter, essentially. But what a conversation does in video form, in audio form, when you have guests about your niche and your sub niche, you're creating real true to form backlinks. And you're building an audience and then you're building a network as well. And then on top of all of that, to bring it home to the Content Creators Club, you're creating content that you can then distribute across all of your channels. You build that into a newsletter. You send that out over social. And then you've got this, you know, media machine that's working for you, all surrounded around your niche.
Yep. 100%. That is, and on top of that, it runs on a very good architecture, the RSS, you know, and the rare places. So you really do that. The podcast is, I think, absolutely right in terms of the new multimedia space that was the original blog that we used to interact with. Yeah, 100. I agree, 100%.
Nicola, I was going to ask you, do you go on other people's podcasts who are doing the similar to you?
Not at the moment. No. The show initiated, it's called Seeing Dead People. It's a mystery storytelling podcast with a psychic twist. And the idea is, I have it created it for a little radio station, local radio station online called Radio Sydney. So it just became a show for Radio Sydney, which I've now transferred onto YouTube under Nicola Furlong Mysteries, because I wrote mystery novels in the past. And I now have an audio, and that's my question was going to be, it's an audio podcast at the moment with a few pics, because we use photographs to discuss these historical supernatural events and mysterious events and unsolved mysteries and whatever. But I wanted to understand, is in a podcast, is it better to have some sort of the face-to-face chit chat that you see, that talking heads, which in the old days would have been the kiss of death, but it seems to be a good thing for podcasts, whereas I'm doing mostly just audio at the moment. We're recording together, the psychic and myself, but we aren't recording video. We're recording audio because it's a radio show originally. Should we be recording video? Is that more helpful? Yes.
It's an easy upgrade, to be honest. You can do it with a smartphone, right? My co-host records on his smartphone. I have a DSLR camera that we record on. But it's additional media that you're playing with. You've got audio that you can distribute across all of the audio podcast channels, and then you've got video that you can chop up into short clips that you can distribute across shorts,
as we're gonna
across
do here.
TikTok, mm-hmm. across Instagram Reels, Facebook Reels, you know, LinkedIn, and rinse and repeat, right? Mm-hmm. And it's an easy, little to no cost upgrade that you can do right away.
Yeah, I would 100% say you have to do video. It's unfortunately now become just standard, but I know it's more resource intensive, but Riverside is my favorite. It even has, and not to say good things about AI in this case, but it has AI buttons where it just spits out pieces of content so you could promote with them, you know? So it is low risk, and it is like, I remember when I did multimedia producing, we would do that thing, like you say, with the cell phone. If we didn't have video, I would ask them just to record themselves and send me the video. You know, and this way I'd have at least some social piece that I could repurpose.
Yeah. We are rapidly running out of time here. I said to everyone, a hard stop at an hour. I'm beginning to sense, I kind of already did, but it's been confirmed. Jamie, to me, you're kind of the most interesting man in the world. You know that Old Spice, that Old Spice commercial where the guy's sitting there and he's the most interesting man
in
the world?
He's way more interesting.
That's you. That's you. I could talk to you for hours, and that's not fair to anybody. But how about you give us a few, some of your thinking around some of the upcoming trends. So here we are. We're content creators living underneath the big.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you, Gordon. Thank you. The big platform sort of bottom lines. We're under all those. Okay, So we can't participate in their help.
Right. Right. No, nor can most anybody. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So what are the trends we should be aware of? Maybe what businesses, what categories? Thank you to end us up here.
So I'll give you an example or an anecdote about this. So Sephora, the cosmetics shop, which store, has lately been inundated by 8 to 11-year-olds in the United States who are buying retinol. I don't see the reaction to that. And as anyone who knows that sentence makes, it makes no sense whatsoever. It's questionable how it works in many places, but it definitely doesn't need, 8 to 11-year-olds do not need it. So why are tweens obsessed with Sephora? And it's because influencers are telling them to, because that's what influencers are using when they do their get ready with me. There's a specific genre of media. Retinol is just one of the many steps. But what they're doing is mimicking that. They're saying, I have a recipe of what makes me get ready in my day. And one of those pieces of the recipe is retinol. And so they're going to Sephora and making a mess. But it also, the leverage of that is accidentally causing companies, like Drunk Elephant in particular, to change their label and branding so it's much more acceptable to tweens. So they're basically selling literal snake oil to children because the children don't need it. So what I'm seeing as a trend is that I'm seeing accidental marketing for companies, and that accidental marketing turns into real marketing, which then exploits the consumer more and more. And then again, just like with like the climate change and everything else, blames the consumer for the problem rather than talks about how it works. The bottom line of what I have to get across and remind everybody, and this is something that I talked about in Anything for Fame and my subsequent talks from it, is that remember you're consuming. We use the word of like how we ingest food or like eating things, but we consume media. We consume media as if it is something that's important for us to ingest or digest. So we're now at an overconsumption level. That's what it looks like. Can we digest it all? Like, so what we're looking at is that. And so I think what we have to do, and this is I'll lean on this over and over. We need patience. We need the ability to slow down. We need to have time to digest. We need boredom. We need the ability to disconnect. And so what we do need, and I think maybe in many cases, sometimes Canada does this far better, is public spaces. We need to reverse and go back to the place times when we were enjoying each other's company offline to maintain that the ability for social media to do the right thing. Because we can't, like I said, we're not going to use it, but we have to use it responsibly. So I'm not calling out the influencers that are causing teens to buy retinol unethical. They're just doing their job. They're doing the thing that they've been taught to do. But parents really should have conversation with their teenagers. They should have conversations with the, this should not be a foreign thing. This shouldn't just be drive them to the mall. This should be, why are we doing this? What is this from? And maybe even lean into it. Like the whole idea, like lean into your hyper niche, lean into it and say, can I help you figure this out? Can I help you make this work? Instead of just giving them allowance and having them trash a Sephora store. There's several Sephoras in the US that are carding consumers, you know, like that's an internet effect in real life. So this all said, we have to be responsible. I think for anybody who's seen Anything for Fame, I think that is the takeaway. I'm very happy that Tyler included parents in the film. Like, I think that was really, really important. I think it was important for us to see how parents interact with their children who do influencing. That's a rarity among films like that. And my students, I teach social media. So our constant conversation is about harm more than anything else. Mm-hmm. And when I come into my class thinking about harm in terms of visual problems or pain or things that could go wrong, and they came in saying beauty standards. Like young people have a completely different way of interpreting the words that we may use in social media. So have conversations with other users. That's the best way to do it.
Thank you.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. Jamie, we here in this area are generating community interest in content creation stuff.
Yep.
If you ever need some kind of assistance, I doubt it. But if you ever do,
I probably will.
Somebody to talk to or have a guest speaker, we can help you.
Oh, awesome. Thank you for that offer. Absolutely.
And also, I'll have this video. It's going to be big, but I can share it with you if you would like to use bits of it for your own purposes.
Yeah, let me know.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, this has been extraordinary. Thank you. Thanks
Thank you for the opportunity.
Who's been here. Mm-hmm. And can't wait to talk to you again, maybe as we've all been after maybe 6 to 9 months down the road.
Yeah, when the sequel comes out and you're all in the next film, I hope you invite me to talk.
Fabulous.
To you.
I have one question. The name of the book, you're writing a book right now?
I'm writing a book called Critical Internet Literacies, Reconsidering Creativity, Content, and Safety Online. It comes out at the end of this year or maybe early next year.
Okay.
All right. It is an academic text, but keep in touch and I'll send you a copy.
Oh, absolutely. We will.
All right.
This was a real...
thank you for having me.
Jamie, thank you very much. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Take care to all of you.
Thank you. Thank you again.